So the gist of this paper's argument is that Dunker, in Hallucinating Foucault, her first novel, introduced a poetics of authorial representation which is taken up with all due alterations in her last novel to date, Sophie and the Sibyl. In a nutshell, in both instances, Dunker, in her representation of authors, real, George Eliot, or invented, Paul Michel, prioritizes the unique bond between author and reader. More than a narrative contract, this privileged bond is shown as an act of love, or passion, of profound emotional involvement, entailing rivalry and they, but also hero or heroine worship. This special link whereby the writer courts their readers and the reader is dead keen on meeting their favorite author could be compared to a sort of fandom. Yet it also opens onto a reflection upon the act of reading, going beyond the mostly cognitive reception theory of Wolfgang Iser or other representatives of the school of Constance to take on board affective, somatic, and erotic features. In this respect, the writer-reader mutual partnership acquires an emancipatory function which is principally gender-oriented. Homosexual love, seen as contesting bourgeois order in Hallucinating Foucault, and gender fluidity and a commitment to feminism, upsetting the two-sphere dichotomy in Sophie. After setting out briefly parallels and correspondences between Hallucinating and Sophie to tease out lines of continuity, this study will focus on the latter as a neo-Victorian fiction, showcasing a canonical but also multifaceted Victorian novelist, George Eliot, the Sibyl of Mercia, Polly, Marian Evans, the unofficial Mrs. George Henry Lewis, and the socially endorsed Mrs. John Walter Cross. Amongst the aspects to be tackled, celebrating and wrestling with the icon, then also worthy of interest is the Victorian author in a neo-Victorian romance at the crossroads of history and myth-making, and finally, the triumph of the bizarre over the moralistic and the beautiful, which probably marks a break from standard reception of George Eliot. So my first part is entitled Blue Stocking Bimbos. In Hallucinating, the Germanist provokingly uses the oxymoronic phrase Blue Stocking Bimbos to speak of herself by juxtaposing two clichés, the highbrow spinster and the flirtatious but rather shallow girl. The Germanist is the narrator's girlfriend. Both have intellectual projects. He is writing a dissertation on Paul Michel, an openly gay French writer, utterly dedicated to Michel Foucault, himself a militant gay philosopher who largely contributed to the inception of gay and lesbian curricula on American campuses. She, for her part, does research on Schiller, whom Eliot, another Germanist, knew full well for being familiar with his Mary Stuart and Wallenstein. The Germanist, an androgynous girl, will later prove even more intimately related with Paul Michel, but this is not, strictly speaking, within the compass of this presentation. More to the point, it could be argued that in hindsight, Hallucinating, a novel about a novelist, already contained some of the seeds that were to grow into a more ramified fiction in the Sibyl. At first glance, the Victorian novelist, whom Henry James saw as a horse-faced blue stocking, is also shown by Dunker as being perhaps some kind of bimbo with a mind of her own, at least in the eyes of some bigoted, straight-laced Victorians. What is dismissed by some on moral grounds is praised by others as a sign of emancipation. Some say the Sibyl was fragile, insecure, lacking in confidence and self-esteem. But do frail and timid women decide to be atheists, challenge their fathers, refuse to go to church, educate themselves to an astonishingly high degree, run off to London, live abroad on their own, fling themselves at married men, beguile women too, and clearly enjoy doing so? However, the connections between Hallucinating and the Sibyl could be more profound and structural than these first comments imply, to the point of suggesting the possibility of a pattern in Dunker's treatment of novels about novelists. First, the notion of triangulation could be considered. In Hallucinating, it would place the narrator Paul Michel and Michel Foucault, his virtual mentor, in a network of attraction and seduction. Prompted by his girlfriend, who contends that being in love with the subject of one's thesis is a necessary prerequisite, the narrator sets out on a journey to France, where the former writer and gay activist is legally restrained as a paranoid schizophrenic. The PhD student develops an obsessive bond with its author, which parallels Michel's own passion for his absolute model and ideal reader, Michel Foucault. Letters penned by Michel to his fantasized literary lover and muse, which, as it turns out, were never ever sent to their prospective recipient, constantly underline exclusive passion as the trigger to write. You are the reader for whom I write. I clear a space to write for you, to you, against you. I search for you through the spiral of my phrases. In many respects, Court has years between his absolutely ideal reader and his incarnated English reader. Paul Michel is the fulcrum of textual production and reception. This is probably how the reader should understand the allusion to the Oedipal ogre made by the Germanist to evoke Michel's relation to Foucault. The Oedipal ogre is not reducible to the Oedipus complex, the child's love for the parents of the opposite sex and the attendant drive to kill the other parent of the same sex, but rather as the hub of all passionate investments and affective attachments focused on one emblematic figure, one emblematic tutelary figure, Michel Foucault for Paul Michel and Paul Michel for the doctoral student. This notion of Oedipal ogre also affords another perspective on Harold Bloom's well-known theory of the anxiety of influence, according to which poets must confront their predecessors in a quasi-Oedipal struggle to carve out an imaginative space for themselves. The Oedipal ogre is more the creative force that has to be reckoned with, both as a source of inspiration and as a power to be contested or challenged, yet without being utterly defeated or annihilated. In many respects, the Sibyl stands for such an Oedipal ogre. In Sophie, the triangular model is vindicated right from the third epigraph, in which the narrator comments on her writer's intention to usher in a vindictive little game, which does not purport to be to symbolically erase anyone, as in Bloom's theory of influence, since love is to permeate the whole undertaking. Clearly, the game is to be shared between the implied author, the narrator, and the Victorian novelist, Nedige Frau Lewis, whose intimidating presence in the salons of Dunker and Dunker, her German publishers, cannot fail to cast a spell over everyone in the novel's first pages. Through an oblique technique of presentation, reminiscent of Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim, for example, the Sibyl is shown from some distance, to begin with, as a formidable lady, already lionized after the publication of her first rural novels and at the moment when what many regard as a magnum opus, Middlemarch, is being released in installments. Precisely, the whole point of the novel could be to bring this towering figure down to human proportions, and this is achieved by confronting her to a third party, Count Sophie van Hahn, a feisty young woman who, after being an absolute devotee of Eliot's early novels, loses her temper when she recognizes herself under the feature of Gwendolyn Harless in the gambling room of Leubronn in the first pages of Daniel Deronda. Sophie, a German version of the English New Woman, down to her interest in cycling, subsequently takes the Sibyl to task for failing to grant her winning characters the agency and independence she grabbed for herself in real life. I would not have written your books in the way that you have done. I would not have told women to be satisfied with stage sacrifice, convention, and subservience. I would not have lived one life and believed in another. Of course, at this stage, the reader suspects Sophie of being another partner, together with the implied author and the narrator, in Dunker's vindictive little game by alternating grievances and manifestation of enduring love. Indeed, this constantly shifting image of the Sibyl, repeatedly mediated by third parties, destabilizes the icon, surrounds her with a halo of mystery, but also places her as the fulcrum of passionate investments. Eliot, who may elicit acrimony, is also shown as being stalked by self-sacrificing, utterly dedicated devotees, such Maria Congreve or Edith Jemima Simcox. The latter, probably harbored sapphic sentiments for the hoar-faced, aging novelist, which takes us back to hallucinating in a loop of same-sex passion, tightly bound up with literary creation. My second part is celebrating and wrestling with the icon. Danka both praises Eliot and contends with her. Because after all, a good friend is one you can have a good argument with and still love as before when it is over. The novelist starts by choosing a skewed angle to introduce the Sibyl. Indeed, Victorian scholars regard Eliot as an intellectual writer with a philosophical cast of mind. In a sense, she would be poles apart from Dickens, Mr. Popular Sentiment, who favours melodrama, action-packed plots, and tear-jerking scenes alternating comedy and tragedy. Such rollercoaster plots as Dickens would churn out do not tie in with Eliot's technique, who, according to Gillian Beer, opts for uniformitarianism by meticulously preparing catastrophic events through a slow, gradual incrementation of minor causes. However, Danka chooses to give another image of Eliot by accelerating her novel's tempo and by stringing together events in a romp unfolding at breakneck speed. Significantly, Sophie is subtitled A Victorian Romance, a subgenre one would hardly associate with Eliot, who is more likely to elicit more serious-minded labels, such as a study of provincial life, or possibly something along the line of an insight into the Jewish question. Romance smacks of the silly novels by lady novelists who indulge themselves unreservedly by depicting such improbable situations as heresies, probably peeresses, with perhaps a vicious baronet, an amiable duke, and an irresistible younger son of a marquis as lovers in the foreground. But precisely, this is the point. There might be fun in breaking the formidable Mrs. Lewis's interdict by flouting once in a while the sacrosanct rule of verisimilitude. Admittedly, passion and damnation might be too literally represented in the fiasco surrounding the performance of Wagner's The Flying Dutchman in Sophie. But in the end, the sheer delight resulting from such pandemonium is not lost on the reader. This said, departures from the Eliotian format in Danka's novel are immediately noticeable, though they may be more cosmetic. For instance, the fact that Eliot's famous allographic or autographic epigraphs have been superseded by quaint laconic captions, which gives the novel an overly parodic dimension by recalling both the 18th century novel or postmodern pastiches, such as Alice the Grey's Poor Things. All in all, one can't help but feel that her hoax is being played on the Madonna, another name for George Eliot, who nonetheless remains unruffled and makes a show of her dignity, happen what may, as if butter would not melt in her mouth. And I'm moving on to my third part, which is going to be a few comments on history and myth-making. History can fulfill a double function, which is decisive for the book's structure and purpose. It lends a veneer of spurious authenticity to the fiction by playing on the thin, porous borderline between fake and fact, and it also allegorizes the attempt to resurrect, to lend a new, albeit skewed, lease on life to an eminent Victorian, George Eliot. The Sibyl impresses Max Danka right from the start by quizzing him, as it were, on Lucian, whom he's supposed to be reading. I'm not sure of myself here. Lucian then reappears throughout the novel through a putative fragment and letters to Miriam, a private correspondence supposed to relate the philosopher's passion for a Palestine slave who happened to be a member of the new fast-spreading faith, Christianity. Patricia Dunker sometimes invents authors, Paul Michel is of course an example, or she fictionalizes real historical figures with an undecidable identity, like James Miranda Barry. Interestingly, with Lucian, the reader remains poised between fake and fact, and this uncertainty rebounds on the Sibyl by enhancing her intrinsic mystery. After all, a Sibyl cannot be pigeonholed or circumscribed, and her memory remained free-floating for eternity. So by bringing in Lucien, the novelist embarks the reader on a wild goose chase. Quote, shouldn't Lucien, the Latin Lucien, not the Greek one, been there somewhere? Or was he chased among the poets? Or was he classed among the poets? Wonders Max, nonplussed by the Sibyl's question when she asked him what he thought of Lucien. The fact is that Lucien of Samosata is and is not Greek or Latin. He lived in Syria, which was a Roman colony, and he wrote in Greek. Debate actually focused on whether he was Greek or Syriac. And he wrote dialogues featuring both mythical and historical figures. His writings displayed characters bearing names very similar to his own, like Lucinos, Lucianos, or Lucian, let alone the Syrian, as if to signify the presence of masks, alter egos, and mouthpieces, which is what Charlotte was pointing at a few minutes ago. In his true history, Lucien recounted in tongue-in-cheek a travel to the moon, so that the narrator is justified to signal this visionary dimension. Lucien saw the terrible contours of the future. However, despite the many pieces in which he allegedly staged himself, the classicist Donald Russell remarks that a good deal of what Lucien says about himself is no more to be trusted than the voyage to the moon that he recounts so persuasively in the first person in the true stories. And it is foolish to treat the information as autobiography. Lucien was also trained as a sculptor. And at some point in Sophie, it is the original, with a lot of inverted commas, the original statue representing Lucien, which is carried over from Miletus to the British Museum after an archaeological expedition to Anatolia led by Professor Kurt Marek. The name is authentic, as is the name of Olivier Rayet, who had undertaken the same expedition the previous year. I realized that I was more comfortable with myth than history, warns the narrator at the beginning. George Eliot comes out aggrandized, magnified from this combination between the transformative shape-shifting power of myth and the erudite precision of history. In conclusion, Dunker probably does not intend to carve any hagiographic statue of the Victorian novelist. Lucien's statue, by the way, is a poetic license, though a tantalizing one. Because he is unputdownable, Lucien defies the very possibility of being fixed in neat stone contours, as does the Sibyl. Dunker wishes to conjure up the not herself that took possession of Eliot. Eliot, known mostly for being rational, studious, and sparingly calculating and intellectual. This intractable imagination, which, to cite Dunker's lyrical coda, reads the underground seams, then stares unflinching into the darkness ahead, is not amenable to the biography format. It may be said to be both genre and gender bending. Propounding classification tables, Latin or Greek, history or myth, fact or fake, fiction or non-fiction, in order to undermine the logical foundations of such antinomies, evinces the fluidity, plasticity, and metamorphic pliancy of what could be seen as queer epistemology. In Sophie and the Sibyl, it harmonizes the sheer pleasure of adventurous storytelling with the afterthought of self-reflexive, metafictional narration. Thank you.